On today's episode, we are back again for another Q&A. Welcome to the podcast helping you train, rehab, and run smarter. When I first started running in my 20s, I knew it would be something I'd be passionate about for the rest of my life. But unfortunately, developing injury after injury disrupted my progress and left me undertrained at the start line on race day. Even with my knowledge as a physio, I still fell victim to the vicious injury cycle, and when searching for answers, struggled to decipher between common running myths and evidence-based guidance. That's what this podcast is here to help you with. So join me as a Run Smarter scholar, and let's break the injury cycle by raising your running IQ and achieving running feats you never thought possible. Welcome back, Run Smarter Scholars. Yes, we have our second edition of the Q&As. I answered four or five of your questions last week, and now we're tackling them again to finish off the remaining questions that I had selected. We're covering mainly, like I said last time, it's hard to sort of filter out which ones to include, but came together with some themes. We're going to talk about shoes today. We're going to talk about rehab, and hopefully you find a good balance. Hopefully, even if these don't meet your specific focuses or issues that are going on at the moment, hopefully you're still learning for maybe future issues that come up. But our first question comes in from Anna, who says, as a trail runner and a doctor, I know the evidence has changed. Rest is no longer recommended for injuries and lots of focus on strength. But I also know that most of my injuries are due to overuse or lack of recovery. So how do I know when to back off? Is rest never the answer? Excellent, Anna. Thanks for your question. Yes, you're completely right. Complete rest is, I guess, rarely recommended. And why it was initially an idea, because we thought that, you know, the body does a good job of healing. If you overload your body with running and you have pain, might as well back off running, let things settle down, let the body do what it naturally does, which is heal, and then you should get back into it. But when it comes to overuse injuries, we don't like to have complete rest for too long. In fact, we often recommend doing at least a little something, probably a lot sooner than you think, to at least preserve some fitness, preserve some strength, and just the idea being not to exacerbate things. And back in the early days or the early episodes of the podcast, I have 10 universal principles to reduce risk of injury and overcome your current injury. If you're not familiar, if you haven't listened to the first 10 episodes, go back to them because they are continuing to help people. I talk about the pain, rest, weakness, downward spiral, which seems to resonate with a lot of people who have an injury or a chronic injury. Essentially being like, if you have pain and you treat it with rest, then it fosters weakness. And if you are weak, well, if it deconditioned and then you return back to that activity, pain is going to come on a lot sooner because you are reaching your capacity or you're overloading that structure sooner. So then people combat that with more rest, which contributes to more weakness, and the downward spiral continues. And so we don't want to find ourselves anywhere near that downward spiral, and the appropriate load is the right answer. So what we need to do is, the right answer is, okay, once things have calmed down in like a day or two, we want to load within your adaptation zone. And that's a very safe answer, but very hard to pick out exactly where that zone is. But that is completely different from overload. So it seems with your question, Anna, when you're like, okay, I'm getting injured from overload, but if rest isn't the answer, how do I know? Well, the answer's somewhere in between. We need to try to find what's a challenging or appropriate stimulus to preserve strength or even build upon strength that doesn't put you into overload, doesn't increase your symptoms. And that's where we find like a green, yellow, red light kind of system. Green, orange, red system, and having some sort of guidelines around symptoms to know whether it was acceptable or not. I often talk about Symptoms during activity should be relatively low. We want to try and keep it under like a 4 or a 3 out of 10. Making sure there's no exacerbation of symptoms thereafter. Hopefully symptoms return back to baseline in less than a few hours. But if symptoms elevate and they're prolonged beyond your baseline with after 24 hours, you've definitely done too much. And so it's following the symptoms during the activity, after the activity, and the next day to then gather that data and see whether that's an appropriate amount. If you're above baseline, means that you've probably pushed too much. If you're back to baseline, it means we're probably fostering within that adaptation zone. But then we also want to see improvements week by week to know that we're really load managing this particular area appropriately. And so, yes, we want to try and find that. If you are unsure where that is, or you keep trying to find it yourself and still struggling, then that's when a therapist or myself, we can get involved and come up with a plan and help interpret symptoms together. But when it comes to like specific injuries, say for like a muscle strain, if we're talking about a muscle, we could have a calf strain, which is very classic with runners, I guess. I guess you could get some hamstrings, maybe quad. Don't really see too many other muscle strains for recreational runners. But let's just say you have a calf strain. Even like, yes, we might rest for day 2, day 3, maybe day 4, we're starting to look to load again, depending on the grade of the injury, depending on any other complications. But that's what we're sort of looking to do. And that's a lot sooner than people probably think. If it's a grade 2 strain, you know, I would be okay with loading someone day 4, day 5, but it just depends on what that load is. Yes, we would use those same pain guidelines as a bit of a structure to see what is right or wrong. Because if you're walking and walking is a 4 out of 10 by day 4, we're definitely not loading in that sense. We're definitely not getting you to do any walking or any running. But if it's a grade 2 strain and walking is like a 1 out of 10, I'd probably say, okay, let's try to load it, but maybe with some cycling, some low intensity cycling, or maybe some hiking, or maybe doing the Stairmaster or the elliptical. That would be a good one to provide some sort of stimulus through the calf, but just not as much as what running would do. But if by day 5 and 6 you've got, you know, pain with walking is symptom free, then we might try, I don't know, jogging on the spot. We might try a little bit of jumping, maybe double leg jumping, maybe a jump rope at a small amount, and then to see how things are afterwards. And if things are tolerated and back to baseline within 24 hours, maybe we do a walk run program and accelerate you through. It's all just using those symptoms as guidelines as to how much we can and can't push. But each time we progress that particular activity, we're sort of stimulating the area more and more, and then seeing what the response is like. For a tendinopathy, like that's even, well, again, depends on how severe it is and the location of the body, but I would load it day 1, day 2, and I would load it pretty heavily, depending on symptoms. But in a general sense, tendons like slow, heavy load. So we'd want to load people up. Yes, running might irritate it. Yes, running could flare up symptoms. But if you do some slow, heavy, say, heel drops for an Achilles tendinopathy, or if you do very slow, heavy deadlifts for a proximal hamstring tendon, that you might actually find that symptoms feel better because tendons, they enjoy that slow, heavy load. And so rest isn't really the best for those, that area as well. Even if we have an ankle sprain, like we used to, I know I played basketball, I rolled my ankle growing up a lot of times, and rest, ice, compress, elevate was what we would do, that RICE acronym. And rest, it's like the first one in there, rest, ice, compress, and elevate. But now, yeah, sure, you might rest for 24 hours, but as soon as you are able to, you are trying to mobilize that ankle, you are trying to do some balancing exercises. As soon as you are able to walk, you are going to walk. As soon as you are able to squat, you are going to squat. And we're restoring that function as soon as possible and trying to have the minimal amount of rest possible, once we've ruled out a fracture or some other complications that might happen. And so, yes, we shy away from rest. Sure, that rest might be 1 or 2 days, but as soon as possible, we want to try to get some load through that area in the appropriate amount. And I know, Anna, you put just at the end, or is rest never the answer? I guess, you know, with things like bone stress reactions, we do want to be a lot more conservative than, say, muscle strains and tendinopathies and those sorts of things. Sometimes rest is required, but even these days we're slightly shifting the narrative. Sometimes we used to put people in casts or on crutches. It all depends on the degree of the bone stress or the bone stress fracture and the location it's in, because there are some high risk areas and some low risk areas. If it's a high risk area and in terms of its level of severity throughout the pathology, if it's quite severe and it's in a high risk area, maybe we would put people on crutches or do that rest. So there are some scenarios where rest might be the answer, but like I say, even now we're sort of shifting our focus towards, okay, well, what loading can we do through this bone? If it is like the shin, or if it is the femur, or if it is like a foot bone, what sort of load is appropriate? But we will definitely be a lot more conservative than those other examples I just gave. The other things I could think about when it comes to relative rest, if it's a real acute flare-up and you're in a real amount of pain, then yes, we would take a couple of days off, maybe take some pain medication if appropriate, and try to really calm things down. And the other one's just like overtraining. If you have like overtraining syndrome or like some systemic signs and symptoms, like a lot of fatigue, really run down, really like emotionally unstable or disrupted sleep and malnourished, or there's some like real systemic signs of overtraining syndrome, then yes, you would need to rest. Your body is telling you you're not going to do any exercise. So that is something very serious that we need to take. Those are some of the scenarios that I sort of come up with where rest might be a little bit more of an answer than some others. And back to, I guess, more of your question, Anna, you're talking about like, how do I know if most of my injuries are overuse, how do I know when I should back off? Well, again, we want to come back to training within your adaptation zone, making sure that if you aren't injured and you want to reduce your risk of injury, we want to make sure that your training is, avoiding and safe from any abrupt changes. Yes, we can progress your running. Yes, we can run further, faster, harder, but it just needs to be safe progressions, recovering adequately, and making sure that your body is telling you that you're tolerating week by week, you're tolerating those loads. And so we can also look out for early signs of injury. I know I've had Eric Hegedus, a US-based running researcher, on the podcast before, and he mentioned that there are 4 signs, early signs, that you want to look out for to make sure that you're adjusting your training appropriately, because if you're ranking poorly in these 4 domains, an injury is just around the corner if you don't intervene. One of those is being just generic muscle soreness. So DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness. If you are having excessive amounts of DOMS compared to usual, and it's like disrupting most of your week, then that's one domain. DOMS is fine. If you do a really hard workout and you're sore the next day or two and that's normal for you, then fantastic. We actually encourage that. But if it is excessive and if it's getting more excessive than your norm, that's one domain. The other domain is sleep disturbances or poor sleep quality. We want to make sure that we're monitoring our sleep, or at least making sure we're getting enough sleep. Stress, and I mean like daily stress, emotional, psychological stress. We want to make sure that that domain is in check as well. And fatigue, just general body fatigue, feeling run down, feeling tired, less energetic than usual. if you are ranking, like, it's okay to be stressed some weeks. It's okay to have poor sleep some weeks. I think I mentioned last week that I hadn't had much sleep and I backed off my training accordingly, preemptively because of that. It's okay to do these things, but if you are ranking poorly in these four domains, DOMS, fatigue, sleep, stress, then you need to really consider adjusting your training if you don't want to get injured. So a few other little tidbits there, Anna. Thanks for your question. It's really prompted a lot of things on my end that I thought I'd share. So hopefully that helped. Dominic asks, how to safely transition from high cushioned shoes to minimalist barefoot shoes? Just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know, I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow. Does the barefoot approach really reduce a lot of injuries? If so, why elite runners don't run with minimalist shoes? I'm reading Born to Run and I'm a bit puzzled by this. Oh, the Born to Run paradox. A lot of people are confused and puzzled when they do this and when they read. Okay, let's dive into that. So I've read Born to Run as well. It's one of my first ever running books and I did buy into that particular narrative. I went towards minimalist shoes. I love them. I loved the feel of them. Thankfully, I didn't get injured and I run in, most of my running is in minimalist shoes now because I just really, really like them. I enjoy them. But, you know, we try not to put our own, our own biases into the advice that we give. The Born to Run movement sort of promotes barefoot shoes. It promotes 4-foot running, so eliminating a heel strike when you run, and it promotes 180 cadence. It does those three things. And if you do those, so the cadence being the amount of steps that you take per minute, most people will look at or research or type in running cadence and the 180 number pops up. It is just a generic blanket bit of advice. Kind of like you need to increase your training weeks by 10% or increase your volume by 10% per week. No real evidence behind it. And people, sometimes it's not good for people. Sometimes it's not optimal for people. When it comes to like changing 4-foot strike, I know this is a bit deviating a little bit away from your question, Dominic, because we're looking at transitioning to minimalist shoes. But you'll know that the Born to Run does promote eliminating a heel strike. There is research. I've talked about the research for years, but there is one paper, a large paper that was titled, "What are the benefits associated with changing foot strike pattern during running? A systematic review and meta-analysis of injury, running economy, and biomechanics." And they specifically say in that paper, I quote, "Changing strike pattern cannot be recommended for an uninjured rear foot striker runner." And they also say there is currently no evidence supporting transitioning from rear foot to rear foot strike or like a heel strike to non-rear foot strike will reduce injury risk. And so heel striking is completely fine. What barefoot, the Born to Run barefoot movement tries to create, the illusion tries to create is that heel striking creates a braking force, which is undesirable. It's in front of your body. It's a large slam on the ground. And it's like this overstride braking force pattern. But, you know, most of the runners, most recreational runners, 90% of runners are heel strikers. That's what we naturally do. And you can very well, yes, if you are heel striking and you are overstriding and you have a large braking force, we don't want that. But there's this, the vast majority of heel strikers aren't creating a braking force. They're contacting closer to their center of mass and it's totally fine to do. There is no link with injury and people can be very successful. Most marathon runners, most professional elite marathon runners are heel strikers and they're completely fine. So I think they've put into a camp, okay, that they've sort of assumed or making people assume that every single person that heel strikes has a large breaking force. It's too far in front of their body. They hit the ground too hard, which isn't true. Now back to the barefoot shoes. So yes, Born to Run does promote barefoot shoes to reduce risk of injury, to increase running performance. You know, everything falls into place as soon as you just start running in barefoot shoes. Okay, there is a risk of injury transitioning to barefoot shoes. For sure there is, because like I said with Anna's question, we want to avoid abrupt changes in training. And sometimes that abrupt change might be going from a supportive shoe to a minimalist shoe. And when we transition to a minimalist shoe, your feet, your foot bones, your plantar fascia, your calf, your Achilles, the little muscles in your feet, they need to work so much harder than if they had supportive shoes. And so if you start running in barefoot shoes too quickly, yes, there is a heightened risk of bone stress fractures in your foot. Achilles tendinopathies, calf strains, plantar fasciitis, you name it. Anything below the knee, any sort of injury below the knee. So we need to be very, very careful if you want to do it anyway, because yes, the research can point to if you have lighter shoes, that helps increase running economy, but you can just as easily have lighter shoes that are supportive and achieve the same thing. So we need to be very careful with how we're prescribing this. If you want to transition anyway, because yes, like when I wear my shoes, when I wear my minimalist shoes, they are lighter than say my other standard running shoes. And I do feel like it feels nice when I run in them, but my foot is very strong. Like I've made the transition process and I've been running in minimalist shoes for years and years. So my foot has built up the resilience to run in those things. But when it comes to like performance and when it comes to, you know, having those lighter shoes contributing to running economy, there will definitely be diminishing returns, especially once the race and the event itself gets like longer and longer in terms of distance, because then fatigue starts to play a role. Because if I wear minimalist shoes for a marathon, my foot is, you know, taking on the responsibility of running, or more responsibility, and they're going to likely fatigue a lot sooner than if I was in a shoe that had support, or sort of like a maximalist, or like a more rigid foam, or a heel stack, or something along those lines. And so this is probably where we're getting to, where Dominique, you're talking about why elite runners don't have minimalist shoes, because they are almost exclusively, when it comes to marathons, wearing carbon plated shoes, which has the ability to increase your running performance. Good research on that. But also is supportive. It has the support for the feet to, so you don't get fatigued like you would in minimalist shoes. So that's, the research has shifted. I know Barefoot, the Born to Run book also has a sequel. I did a review on it on YouTube probably about a year ago, and I wanted to see what, if their stance had changed, because they had this, the Born to Run book, the initial one, it's essentially cherry-picked evidence. You can come with anecdotal small studies here and there and make a really compelling case. In fact, when you read the book, like everyone who reads the book, well, not everyone, most people who read the book, they're like, oh my God, this is the answer. 180 cadence, barefoot running, non-rear foot striking. This is, everything's falling into place, all the research and all the stories that they're telling, and then you do that, but after the release, even after the release of the book, there's been way more compelling evidence countering that narrative. So when I bought the Born to Run 2 book, I'm like, okay, well, will they have a more of a balanced perspective, or will they just double down and sort of continue cherry picking evidence? And that's exactly what they did. They continued to cherry pick evidence, still promote the exact same philosophy, which they should, I guess, from a marketing perspective. They've gained a big movement, but people have I guess the craze, the trend is sort of like dying down. Well, definitely has died down. I think it was like the early 2000s when it really kicked off. But, you know, now if you look at the big shoe brands, they're not really coming out with minimalist shoes that much, whereas they did during that trend. Now it's more supportive, carbon fiber, all that sort of stuff, just because, okay, a lot of people may have transitioned into minimalist shoes and found it wasn't right for them. Maybe they started getting injured and stopped buying them. Because if people were buying them, shoe companies would keep making them, and now they're nowhere to be seen. So be very careful with cherry-picked evidence, and I'm always here to try to provide a balanced perspective. And this only answers half your question, Dominic, because I know you're asking about how to safely transition into your minimalist shoes. There is actually a good paper. The title of it is Transitioning to Minimal Footwear, a Systematic Review of Methods and Future Clinical Recommendations. So you can go find that article if you want, because they have a pretty nice recommended guidelines, and they actually have some images of, you know, what to do, how to transition. I've got it in front of me. Let me just scroll down and find it. So let me scroll down. This is a long paper. How many weeks is that? 4 weeks. A four-week transition phase where they've just provided different bits of advice. So week one, they say do two things. One, you're actually going to reduce your training volume by 10 to 20%. So your overall running volume is going to overall reduce. You're doing that for week one. And you're not even wearing your minimalist shoes during your running. You're going to wear your minimalist shoes doing other activities like walking, hiking, strength training. You're going to do that for week one. Week two, we're now going to start transitioning into using your minimalist shoes during your running, but it's going to be a very, very small amount. They say here, gradually increase exposure to minimalist footwear, i.e. 5% of your run on 3 days, but not more than 5 minutes per run. So that's not a lot. Week three, we're increasing yet again. So we're increasing by about 5%. And by week four, we're increasing it to another 5%. And we're looking at by week four, where sort of the bulk of your running is probably about 20% of it is in your minimalist shoes throughout the week. And then you can slowly build your mileage back up to where it was. Because remember, by week one, we reduce your volume 10 to 20%. By week four, we're picking that 10 to 20% back up again. So that's some generic advice, but it obviously depend on your symptoms and also depend on unique circumstances, such as like how strong your feet are. Like, do you strength train already in minimalist shoes? Do you already walk barefoot? Like trying to just establish what the strength is prior to that minimalist transition, because it will completely depend. Okay, Craig asked a question that sort of ties in a little bit with this. He asks, recently, I was lucky to get a pair of Ultra Vanish Carbon during the limited time special. I was sort of debating on using them for a marathon at the end of May. So we're looking at, maybe 8 weeks away. He asks, how many times would you recommend running in these shoes prior to the race? Good question, Craig. A lot of people would be in the same boat with different shoes and preparing for races and those sorts of things. You do need to weigh up the risk versus reward. 8 weeks, yeah, that's a fair amount of time to transition into a different type of shoe and sort of work out if your body's ready for it or not. Some people it might be 4 weeks, some people it might be, you know, a lot longer. So we want to weigh up like how much time we have available and how much risk we are willing to take on. Do we want to risk really changing our shoes at this point of our training plan to then possibly run in those shoes throughout the marathon? Really need to weigh that up. The factor that we would keep in is like, okay, how similar are they to the shoes that you are already adapted to? Because if that shift is not too much, if the type of shoe is more similar, then it's less risk that we have to take on. But if you are as an extreme example, if you are used to maximalist shoes like Hoka and you go straight to like a barefoot shoe, that is completely different. We need to be very, very, very conservative with the transition. But if we're going to something that's a little bit more flexible, maybe a slightly less heel drop, maybe a little bit lighter, maybe a little bit less supportive, then we don't need to be as conservative. And so with these individual factors do need to play in. So I guess, Craig, my question would be like, what previous shoes have you run in and what previous shoes are you accustomed to? Because then we can sort of go back to weighing up that risk versus reward. We do need to be careful with carbon fiber shoes. I did a podcast episode looking at a study. The title was Bone Stress Injuries in Runners Using Carbon Fiber Plated Footwear. And it was sort of like not necessarily like a randomized control trial or something like that. It was more just this particular researcher has found a particular pattern with those who have transitioned to these super shoes, these carbon fiber shoes, and started developing stress fractures within the bones of the feet. I think it was like the navicular, from memory, the navicular bone within your foot. And just like had several case reports of like seven different runners who went through their history of their experience with transitioning into carbon fiber shoes and their foot pain and their eventual diagnosis. So if you're interested in that, I did a previous episode. The title of the episode was similar to the paper. It was titled Bone Stress Injuries in Runners Using Carbon Fiber Footwear. So if you wanted to search that in your podcast directories, that should pop up. A bit more practical advice for you, Craig. So you can try wearing these shoes in like your short speed sessions. So if you're doing strides or if you're doing like really short, say 1 to 2 minute intervals, you could probably do it for a few of those intervals. Then just reassess after and see how's my body feeling. Then you might want to try doing them during some moderate tempo sessions, say like, you know, running at race pace for 15 to 20 minutes. You might want to see how that's tolerated. And then based on how your body feels, you might want to transition that into like your longer runs and see how you can handle the volume and the duration. But be sensible about it. You do have 8-ish weeks. So you can see how that goes. And again, listening to your body, there might be some early signs of injury that you might say, nope, I'm not willing to take on that risk anymore. I want to transition back to my usual footwear. But like I say, there's no right or wrong. Yes, we can be sensible with our progressions, but you know, it all just depends on that risk versus reward. Lastly, we have a question come in from Debbie, who says, I've been managing 1 year of left knee pain after returning to running following a rectus femoris tendinopathy. The MRI recently showed mild bursitis and joint effusion. I believe it's related to the kinetic chain imbalances, including a right hip shift. Where should my rehab focus be? Should I be exercising my knee at all or solely focusing on improving my hip mobility? Okay, thanks for your question, Debbie. I don't really heavily prescribe to what people have been told if they have slight imbalances. I'm assuming it is a slight imbalance. I'm assuming someone has told you that, like you say, you have kinetic chain imbalances, whether it's like a hip shift, one leg longer than the other, one side activating more than the other, something along those lines. I am yet to be convinced that those slight imbalances are linked to an increase in injury or linked to, you know, a failed rehab. What I am more concerned about and what I focus more on is overall load management of that particular tissue. So again, hard to know the specifics because the MRI has shown mild bursitis and joint effusion. Okay, is it the effusion? Like what's your current signs and symptoms? Does it fit more something like an effusion, which would be more like the whole knee joint feels stiff to move, particularly the next day after, you know, exercising or running too far or too fast, or, you know, standing up from sitting for too long and it feels a little bit stiff. You sort of need to mobilize it for it to feel better. And then it'll have this, like, you know, overall achy, diffuse type of pain sometimes. But then, you know, the bursitis, which bursa, I don't even know. It might be like a bursa behind the knee or to the side of the knee. Does it fit that pattern? Does it look like a golf ball shaped thing on your knee? Because the approach and the treatment would be completely different. You might not even have any of these things. We know with MRIs that mild bursitis or mild joint effusion can be just a normal sign in the healthy population. So you could have, say, patellofemoral pain, which is a totally different diagnosis. It's the most common diagnosis for runners, and an MRI won't pick that up, but will identify all these other incidental findings. So we do need to be very careful with what we do suggest. But I would highly recommend strengthening the knee and having that as the primary focus of your rehab. I wouldn't solely focus on hip mobility stuff. If you are working on knee strengthening, in particular like closed chain exercises, so your foot is fixated to the ground when you strengthen the knee, as opposed to like an open chain where you're swinging the leg like a knee extension machine you find at the gym, that would be an open chain example. But then when we progress these closed chain exercises, you'll eventually start working the hip and you'll eventually start working the whole kinetic chain anyway. So obviously if there are like big hip immobility issues from or differences from right to left, particularly if it severely impacts your running biomechanics, I can't really see that being a factor. But yes, then we would do some hip mobility stuff in conjunction with the knee strengthening stuff. But I would never solely focus on hip mobility and expect any improvement in the knee condition. Like I say, it's mostly a load management issue of the knee. So you can work on some like squat variations. This is all symptom dependent. I have no idea how severe it is, but you can start with wall sits. You can progress to wall squats. You can progress to half range of movement squats. You can progress to sit to stands. You can progress to weighted step ups. Slowly work your way through to meet the demands of running. And can't be ignored, but the running volumes themselves and say your cross training volume needs to be really dialed in. We need to be hitting that adaptation sweet spot and focusing on symptoms. If there are some other things that we can do, like if it is, hypothetically, if it is a joint effusion that is the main issue and it's really stubborn, even with good treatment, like good mobility exercises, good load management exercises, good strengthening exercises, if it's still being really stubborn, we can remove that effusion. We call it aspirate. An effusion is essentially a little bit of fluid that's gathered within the knee joint. And if it's being really stubborn and not clearing, then they actually inject a needle and extract that fluid out of that knee. And that can actually provide a lot of benefit. I've actually seen some really good outcomes with my clients if they do have a really stubborn knee joint effusion. But you'd want to start conservative first before even considering that. And if it's a bursitis, then a corticosteroid injection can be helpful. So, like I say, I don't know if you even present with any of these things, but some other approaches can be effective as well. Hopefully that helps, Debbie. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Dominic. Thanks, Anna, for asking these questions. I do enjoy doing these Q&As. I will see how I go if I end up doing another in the next couple of months. I've got a couple of interviews coming up with two different researchers, one talking about power meters, the other talking about tendinopathies. Tendinopathy one's really, really interesting. But diving a bit more into the science, practical ways you can run smarter. So I look forward to bringing you those. And until next time, remember, every new insight brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough. If you are struggling to overcome an injury, you can jump on a free 20-minute injury chat with me, which you can book through my calendar in the show notes. While you're in the show notes, elevate your running IQ by jumping onto my free email list so you can receive material to help rehab your injury, lower your injury risk, and increase your performance. If emails aren't for you, consider my Facebook group, Instagram, and YouTube channels. And remember, each insight you get from these resources brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.